Everybody comes into our profession with traumas, with triggers, and we don't know how it's going to affect them. So before we criticize and before we make judgment, why don't we sit down and have a conversation with the person to see where they're at and how we can help them and be a conduit to get them resources. So here's the challenge. Instead of buying 10 new cars next year for your organization, buy 9 and put that $50,000 or $60,000 into a wellness budget. And it's not about leading the organization. It's about having influence on the profession. Can you imagine the day when you could go to a briefing and this, you know, these macho police officers who never shared emotions in the past are now talking about which therapist people are using?
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Bonnie Rumeli and Stacey Raymond. This is David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Chief Neil Gang about organizational wellness and leadership in emergency services. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is ResponderTV.com. We'll be right back to speak with Chief Gang after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by Chief Neil Gang, who's been the Chief of Police in the Pinole, California Police Department since 2014, and he served in law enforcement for over 34 years. Neil's the chairperson of the California Police Chiefs Association Organizational Wellness and Resiliency Committee and co-chair of the IACP Officer Safety and Wellness Committee. And he's also the author of the Asher Model 7-Point Approach to Culture of Wellness and the host of the Sixth Pillar podcast. Neil was named Public Safety Hero of the Year by the House of Representatives in 2020, and his innovative work as a law enforcement leader has been featured in several national police magazines. Chief Gang, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me, and super blessed to join your crew and the amazing work that you're doing.
Thank you. It's great to have you here.
So I'll start off. Chief, did you ever imagine that you'd be in this position as chief of the Pinole, California Police Department? What was that like for you to ascend through the ranks?
No, absolutely. I knew exactly where I'd be. No, I'm just kidding. With you. I honestly never thought about even becoming a police chief. In fact, as I moved up the ranks, it was just something that continued to challenge myself personally and professionally. And, you know, sooner or later, you're at the point where there's only one more step, and that is to be the leader of an organization. And it's not about leading the organization. It's about having influence on a profession. And sometimes you can't do that unless you are the chief of police. So it was never in my cards. And in fact, I never even wanted to be a police officer. And it was something that I just kind of tripped on. And what I was going to do while I was hurt from playing college football was going to be a police officer for a little bit. And here I am 34 years later. So I think I still have some eligibility left. I may go back.
Retirement gig.
We all know that you can't just do this for a little bit. Once you get sucked in, it's you're in.
Absolutely.
So when you think about, you said something very interesting about becoming chief, that it wasn't about you, but it's about making a difference in your profession. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just because we see a lot of viewpoints, right? And there are a lot of different leadership styles, but that's a really great comment I want to hear more about.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of leaders out there that are doing it for their resume and doing it for themselves, but it's really about being a servant leader. And I know that that word gets thrown around a lot, but really about just being there to help serve the people that are working in this profession. And I continue to say, and what drives me every day and my passion to get up every morning and put this uniform and badge on is my ability to provide resources to the people that are working in Pinole, but not just in Pinole, but be able to influence positively the entire profession. And mm-hmm. and really, again, that's what the passion that keeps driving me. And that's what keeps me every day, you know, getting dressed and enthusiastic about continuing to work in policing.
And you're spreading the word in many different ways. One of them is we have had the pleasure of having Conrad Weaver on the show as a guest, talking about his movie PTSD 911.
I have 4 years till retirement, and I got to be okay, and I got to make it.
Right now, our profession is being challenged. We're going through a really, really difficult season. There's no time like the present where officer wellness has to be your number one priority. We have to do a better job as leadership in our profession to understand that is what we're dealing with, people. And I think it's really important that is our number one resource, and that it has to be our number one priority moving forward if we want to change this profession.
And I know that your department and you were kind of pivotal in making that movie a reality. Can you talk a little bit about the role that the Pinole Police Department played and then what it was like having a film crew riding along?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And Conrad's a great guy, and the effort that they put into this documentary and having an opportunity just to have a small piece of that is really a blessing for us at the Pinole Police Department. Really, honestly, it's about sharing our message and our narrative. And as first responders, we don't do that very well, but we always say there's a human behind the badge, but there's really a heart behind the badge. And mm-hmm. this really gives us an opportunity to kind of peel back the layers a little bit and allow people to realize that this is not who we are, right? This is just a profession that we do. And that there's everybody that comes with this, there's a human behind that, and there's impacts and there's traumas in our profession. They say a major in a career, someone will sustain about 188 major traumatic events in our profession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not shared around the country. You know, there's no news media outlets sharing that. So I think we had the opportunity really kind of to show everybody what the heart is behind the badge. And we are susceptible to all of the life's challenges on top of the challenges of being in policing right now.
I think chiefs have a multitude of competing interests, responsibilities as well, right? Along with recruitment, retention. There's so many different topics that you have to tackle, but how do you let your people know in your organization that they're important in the busyness of leading? How do you do that on a day-to-day basis?
You know, for me, it's about prioritizing our people, right? They're our greatest resources. So we have to make them our top priority. And how you do that is by, you know, creating a culture of wellness for the organization, showing them that they come before the community. And I know that's difficult for a lot of police leaders to say, but it has to. And I'll just frame it like this. Could you imagine an NFL football coach that cared more about the people sitting in the seats than the people playing on the field? How successful would that team be? So it's the same thing for policing. We have to prioritize our people. It has to be our number one priority. And how we do that is creating a culture of wellness and then also establishing budgets, right? So we can have sustainable mm-hmm. programs. And the bottom line is many chiefs out there have not have a budget string to deal with wellness. So how impactful is that to your people when you know you want to bring resources and initiatives, but there's no funding behind that? Uh-huh. So we have to prioritize that. We have to budget, because what we prioritize is what we will budget. You know, we'll budget the next, greatest 21st century widget, but we're not prioritizing our people and putting funding where that needs to be. So here's the challenge. Instead of buying 10 new cars next year for your organization, buy 9 and put that $50,000 or $60,000 into a wellness budget. So you have those mm-hmm. initiatives when people need it.
In a practical sense, as a leader in your organization, and maybe even applying to other leaders below you who are supervisors, how do you create that cultural wellness? Like, how much of it is policy? How much of it is informal, you know, just the way that people talk to each other in the department? Like, how does that kind of play out?
Yeah, and Dave, you and I had a conversation a little bit earlier about that. It's about the leadership of the organization, mm-hmm. right? Leaders have to be able to take those conversations out of the shadows, share their experiences with their people. We have to normalize these type of conversations. So it's all the above, right? We have to have great policies in place, but it's more about the policies. It's about the actions and making sure that the leaders in your organization, that their words and their actions are congruent. Because the minute they're not, people will lose trust, and then your program is done. And the bottom line is there's so many people out there just doing checkbox programs. They really have to be impactful programs. And you're not just doing it for your community to hear, or maybe your council or your political partners, but about people in your organization. They have to know they come first. And you do that every day. And it's the same way I say, the same way you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. You will not create a culture overnight. And you can't create a culture by checking off a box. It's the day-to-day interactions, the day-to-day steps, and the day-to-day conversations that you'll have that eventually one day you'll wake up and go, wow, we have a decent culture in this organization where people are willing to raise their hand, say, I need help, or even talk about, you know, the help that they're receiving. Can you imagine a day when you can go to a briefing and this, you know, these macho police officers who have never shared emotions in the past are now talking about which therapist people are using? It's amazing. So that is where it's really anecdotal. People say, well, how do you measure your success? Well, that sounds great on paper, but how you measure your success is when people in your organizations are talking about these freely and openly in briefings and throughout other interactions that you have with them.
So really, it's from the top down trying to institute a cultural change. That's really what you're saying, is having people embrace wellness and be okay with asking for help, admitting that they're getting help, especially if they're not going to get penalized, you know, for that. So I'll have a question for you about since programming is wellness programming is something that you're known for. Specifically the Asher model. Who was police officer Asher Rosinsky? Tell us about him and then about the model.
Yeah. Thank you, Stacey. I appreciate the lead in for that. And I wish we had more time and I'd share the entire story, but I'll be brief. Okay. So Asher Rosinsky and I were police officers down in South Florida together. And we went to the academy together in Pembroke Pines, Florida, which is right outside of Hollywood. I was in his wedding. This guy was a decorated Marine before he became a police officer, dedicated father. And, you know, the bottom line is we never know what's going on behind the scenes, and we don't know what's going on inside of people. Everybody talks about, well, what red flags were there? Well, you know, if you're going to sit back and wait for red flags, you're probably going to continue to miss things. So, you know, Asher was a great police officer. You know, if you ever drew a picture and had an ideal of what an officer should look like, it was Asher Rosinsky. I mean, this guy's uniforms, his creases had creases. That's how clean this guy was. And dedicated to the profession, just all he ever wanted to do is be a police officer. Well, he had some off-duty incidents that happened. And what happened was he came back to the organization, and there was something that I talk about. It's called trauma-informed leaders. And this person that was his mentor was not a trauma-informed leader. And it was actually some other words that I probably won't say on the air. But the bottom line is he came back to the organization. This mentor of his continued to tell him he's going to lose his job. He's not going to be able to continue as police officer ever again. And again, this guy's dream about being a police officer came shattering down. But one morning, it's early in the morning, around 3-4 in the morning, and my phone rings. And for some of the millennials out there, that's actually used to be a box on the wall. It wasn't something that's in our pocket.
With wires attached.
Yeah. Yeah. People have no idea what that even is anymore. And I answer the phone, and there's a gentleman screaming on the other side saying, Asher is dead. And he's screaming, crying, says, Asher is dead. And before I could even say another word, they say it one more time. So I sit back and I go, what are they talking about? And for some reason, I guess it was just my way of responding. I thought it was a joke. I thought they were joking. I thought it was a sick joke, but that's what my initial reaction was to it. But the bottom line says, no, Asher, you know, shot himself. And I said, wow, you don't hear about those things. That was in the 90s, you know, so we never thought about those type of things. And, you know, what drove me and where my passion really started was the day after finding out about Asher died and walked into a briefing room with no resources, somebody who was really informed, just really handled things as normal, gave out our beat assignments, gave them out our lunch periods, and told us to go 10-8, which means, you know, go back in service. Mm-hmm. No chiefs, no peer support, no chaplains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the landscape was different back then, so I get it. But it was that day I sat back in my police car and I said, if I ever get an opportunity to be in a leadership position and change mm-hmm. the outcome of these type of incidences, mm-hmm. I'm going to make a difference. And, you know, years and years, decades resonated inside me and eventually came up with the ASHRAE model, which is a 7-point approach to creating culture wellness in our organizations.
Thank you for being so candid about that. And we're sorry that you had to lose a friend. But I think that he'd be very proud to see what you're doing. And the fact that you take all of that pain, you channel it, and you do something that changes the world for police, because we need more of you. Can you try to multiply soon? Because we're trying really, really hard. And I think the change is happening. I think we can all feel it. We're all a part of it, thank God. But I couldn't commend you more on behalf of the three of us for everything that you do.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It means a lot. And you know, if his story or his tragedy can change the outcome of somebody's situation just by hearing it, then it's all worthwhile. What was amazing is that I received a phone call a little bit after the time this ASHRAE model came out. And I'll tell everybody, I'm not an educated person. I'm not a big scholastic type guy. But I wrote an article and it went viral. And it was just the right timing. It wasn't anything great that I did. But and I got a phone call and it was Lisa Brzezinski, which was ASHRAE's widow. And I was so worried about, you know, picking up that phone and having that conversation because I didn't reach out and say, hey, you know, I want to do something in ASHRAE's name. And I thought that it was going to be a negative conversation. And I have to share it because I think our profession just is not open to these type of conversations, because she shared with me for years and years that she tried to go back to our previous organization that I worked in. She tried to go to a police academy to share the experience of what ASHRAE experience was. And she got shunned by the profession. So imagine this lady with so much passion, so much grief, and so much trauma trying to share her story so she could change outcomes, and this profession shunned her. So she said, thank you so much. Thank you so much for allowing ASHRAE's name to be heard and for him to make a difference. And just a really, really was appreciative of what we were doing with ASHRAE's name and the ASHRAE model.
Right. Can you elaborate, Chief, a little bit on the 7 pillars? Just mention the 7 pillars of in this wellness, the ASHRAE model wellness program.
Yeah, Stacey, thank you. So it has to start with number one, right? Awareness. Number one's awareness. And that is creating an environment where it's okay to not be okay, but not just using that buzzword, but doing something proactive to bring it back to okay. Right. Mm-hmm. Taking these conversations out of the shadows and into the open, normalizing these conversations, normalizing these processes. So number one is awareness. And for me, you know, you can't have awareness without doing something proactive. I'm a very I like innovation. I like being progressive. I'm a huge fan of, you know, fortune favors the bold and taking chances that no one's done before. And that's what we had to do. So being solution focused, we went out and got an app. There's a lot of different apps out there, but it doesn't have to be an app if you're somebody who doesn't have the budget for that. Just do something proactive, not just create an environment, but do something proactive. Mm-hmm. And then 3 is creating a proactive peer support team. One of the most proactive steps you could take with little budget is creating a peer support team that's trained. We added a police therapy dog into our program as well, mm-hmm. Which let me give a little hint. I'll talk a little lower for the chiefs out there, but we sell it as it's a great community a tool, but the bottom line is 90% of the impact of that dog is internal. And I wish I had more time to share about that. But so a therapy dog, right. Creating you know, CISM programs and things like that.
Right.
4 for us is resiliency, just building out resiliency, teaching people what that even is, right? Yeah. Educating them on EMDR, educating them on the effects of mindfulness and yoga and all those type of skill sets. So partnering with culturally competent people to come into our police organization and teach our people on what that is all about. You know, the effects of trauma, what PTSD is and all those type of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then 5 is healthy habits, which, you know, we can gloss over, but, you know, creating an environment where people can have healthy habits. You know, many of us get in this profession and we're the most physically fit we'll ever be, right? And then somewhere along the line, you know, these gremlins crawl into our closet and right. they go behind our backs and they take in our inseams. And then years later, you can't get into the
computer. That's us, yeah.
Or our spouses, you know, put in the dryer and they shrink. I don't know how that happens.
Yeah, it's someone else's fault. Yeah.
So creating an environment where they can work out on duty. And not just that, but partnering with the meal prep company so they can bring in healthy meals for our people. Mm. So mm-hmm. working out on duty, reducing those cortisol levels, right, and releasing the endorphins, and then being able to have healthy meals present and available for them so they can take home to their families or they can eat on duty. And then six for us was spirituality. And I'm a man of faith, so we won't talk too much about that. But just understanding that there's something greater than us out there. And then creating a peer support team that included the chaplains mm-hmm. and making the chaplains really a fabric of your organization, not just a checks box or, hey, why is a chaplain here riding with Bonnie today? What did she do? Mm-hmm. You know, so right. just making sure it's the fabric of your organization. Right. And then seven, just if I had a few minutes to talk about family, the importance of bringing family into our organizations. Many of us have started this profession, and even all first responders, families were never really part of our organization when we started out. You know, they came in when you got pinned, maybe as a badge, or you got sworn in,
right.
but really not part of our organization, but really bringing them in and being a part of what we're doing. And then providing resources from rookie to retirement, right? We have to educate our people on financial wellness, and we have to create an environment so they are educated, you know, a couple of years before they retire, because we're losing far too many first responders after they retire to suicide than should ever happen. So just creating those environments where we create those opportunities. Because the bottom line is, if you're not creating that partnership with the families now, it's really going to be difficult when the crisis occurs, right? And I've been a chief for almost 10 years now. Mm-hmm. I've never walked down the hallway and said, hey, how you doing? Well, I'm doing pretty crappy, Chief. I'm actually addicted to opioid drugs, and I'm alcoholic, and I'm currently right. going through a divorce, and I feel like killing myself. That is yet to happen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So we have to create an environment where people at home can call in the organization. They're comfortable calling the chief, or they're comfortable calling your peer support. Hey, my spouse is despondent, and they're more angry, or they're drinking more. Mm-hmm. That is where any red flags will be shown at home. So we need to be able to create that conduit so there's an easy mechanism for them to report that to us. So I hope I didn't take too much time with that, but I think it's important to kind of share the components of it.
No, not at all. And we could dive deep into each one of those pillars. As a matter of fact, several of them really overlap with shows we've done, maybe multiple shows. In some cases, we've done shows on spirituality. We've had a tactical chaplain on who's embedded with departments. And we are talking about leadership and the family as well with some experts in some of our shows.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability, and I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Reflecting back on your pillars, I'm curious why your podcast is called the Sixth Pillar Podcast, and can you tell us a little bit about what that show does?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fortunately reporting out that the show has met with some challenges logistically. So it hasn't really launched yet, but I'm glad you asked about it. It will be up and running next year. I had a partner with a new group to be able to get this out and just be able to have those partners that you trust to be able to do the work that you need them to do. Mm-hmm. The sixth pillar comes from the 21st century policing model. Out of 2015, President Obama formulated a task force to put best practices into place. And sixth pillar is officer wellness and resiliency. So what a great better name to really represent what we're going to try and bring forward right. to the policing profession, but not just the policing profession, but all first responders.
Yes.
I think we face all the same challenges and right. mm-hmm. facing challenges together as a group.
I think what's great too is, you know, we talk about budgets and we know that that's a reality for every department, but a lot of the things that you're talking about require no budget. I mean, for a chief to get out of their office and go downstairs and, you know, go to the dispatchers or go in the break room and get to know their people and just say good morning so that they know they're not just a badge, mm-hmm. that they are being treated as a human. You know, Stacy and I hear that a lot in our offices. Like, I never see my chief, or they never come check on us, or all I would like is a cup of coffee and a good morning. I mean, some of this stuff seems so simple and basic, and really doesn't cost anything. It just takes awareness and effort.
Yeah, I think you brought up a great point. And the bottom line is leadership comes with a sacrifice, right? If not, we'd all be leaders, right? And the bottom line is we have to prioritize our people. And not only that, as leaders, we have to be intentional. And it takes some attention to get up from behind your desk, put mm-hmm. the things that you're doing, because we're all get busy, right? Everybody's plate's
right.
busy.
Yeah.
So put that aside and understand that it's really important to go meet our people. We want our communities to know the officers, right? We want them to see the human behind the badge, but we don't even do it internally. So how can we expect our officers to act that way? So we have to role model. We have to lead the behavior that we expect from our people. And again, it takes intentionality and it does take effort. But the bottom line is, where as a chief would you rather put your effort into? We have to put it into our people, because the number mm-hmm. one, we could have all the initiatives in the world, we could have all the budgets in the world, but if we don't take care of our people, we won't have people wearing the badge and the patch to be able to go out and do the job. You know, I'm not a big Richard Branson fan, but I listened to a podcast one time, and what he said was, in my companies, customers don't come first. My people do. And if you take care of your people, you'll never have to worry about taking care of your customers. Mm-hmm. Now we need to infuse that into first responder, you know, profession, because we really need to take care of our people. And that's what I'll say is, when I lead this profession, if I can get that message out, if we take care of our people and prioritize them, then I'll be happy. I'll be able to retire. But until that point comes, I still got a lot of work to do.
Love to have you talk a little bit about a term you used, trauma-informed leaders. We talk about trauma-informed therapists, but what is a trauma-informed leader?
So going back to the Asher situation, I'm just going to use that as a poor example. It's understanding the leaders and the first line supervisors have to understand that trauma affects people differently. Mm-hmm. Right. And they have to understand that our people are going to face a lot of traumas, and everybody, it affects them differently. They're going to respond differently. And sometimes the behaviors that they're seeing they're not intentional by the employee. Sometimes it's just a result of the trauma that they sustain. So educating anybody in your organization about what trauma is, what it means and what it looks like, mm-hmm. and how people may respond to trauma is really important, because as we lead, we get so caught up in the fact of, this is what I learned in first line supervisor class, and this is how I have to handle a situation. Many times we'll put somebody on a performance improvement plan before we ever sit down and ask them, what's going on and how can I help you? Mm-hmm. So I think it's really just having them be more educated about the human skills, right? The profession is broken in a way, right? We promote the tasks, but we don't promote people with human skills, and that's a whole different conversation. But I think it's part of that, having them be aware of what trauma is, because this is what happens. And I'm sure, Dave, in your experience, you've probably seen this. We may get a call for service where three officers are on scene, and it may be a pretty traumatic call. Right. And the bottom line is the next day, two people come back, but one person stays out because they're sick. Yeah. And what happens?
Right.
The leaders, everybody starts talking about that one negative thing. But we don't know what triggers people. Mm-hmm. Everybody comes into our profession with traumas, with triggers, and we don't know how it's going to affect them. So before we criticize and before we make judgment, why don't we sit down and have a conversation with the person to see where they're at and how we can help them and be a conduit to get them resources before we criticize them?
Well, I'm going to speak the unspoken here, but I wonder how many chiefs themselves have trauma and need help, and how much of the attentiveness or unattentiveness is related to their own traumas. You know, are they avoiding topics or connections because of that reason? You know, so I think it behooves everyone to look at that piece too.
I think, Bonnie, that's such an important aspect, because you remember when we talked about the 188 major traumatic events in the policing career. Mm-hmm. Well, chiefs have been in the career 34 years, mm-hmm. years.
Right.
They may have 188 or more. So this is not just about our people. It's about us as well. And the chiefs have to understand that we have to worry about self-care, because we have to be healthy to take care of our people. It's that whole oxygen mask theory you get on the plane, right? Mm-hmm. What do they tell you? You have to put the oxygen mask on ourselves before we can help others. Same thing here. Police chiefs need to be healthy, pour out into themselves before we could ever expect to pour out into others. So great point that you bring up. And we all carry traumas. I don't care if you've been policing first responders for a minimum amount of time. We're going to have traumas, and we're going to carry those with us.
Going back to the topic of families, how can we be more inclusive of the families, especially, you know, in the context of when they may sense that their loved one is going through a challenging time or is struggling with mental health or other challenges like addiction, self-harm? How can we support them in terms of when they may see a red flag?
Yeah, I think that starts with the conversations early on. And mm-hmm. I said again that it's the same way with the community, right? We have to build relationships with our community before the crisis. Same thing with our families. And that can start and can take a lot of different formats, whatever your organization works, because what may work in Pinole may not work in, you know, an agency on the East Coast, depending on size or chief's philosophies. But the bottom line is being inclusive. So our organization, on the day that people get sworn in, we bring the families in. We give them a tour of the police department. You know, sometimes they don't even get a chance to see where their loved ones are working for 20 years, right? And then the other part is we give them an opportunity to go to our virtual reality training, where they go through the shoot, don't shoot type of scenarios, just to get a picture of what that looks like. Right. And the last part, I think, is the most crucial part, is I sit down with each family member that comes through, and I ask the employee to step out of the room, and I have a conversation with the loved ones. It may be the spouse, it may be the parents, it may be the child. And we talk about that your loved one's going to change over the next several years. We talk about the traumas. We talk about some of these signs that people will see. Hmm. And the last thing I do is I give them a copy of Kelvin Gill Martin's book, Emotional Survivor for Law Enforcement. And I gave each family member a copy of that.
Wow.
Before they go, I answer all questions. And the last thing we do is before we go, we have a QR code in our room where they step up and they get the same exact wellness app that their loved one has. Mm-hmm. So they have all the resources as well at the tip of their fingers so they can help their loved ones get through this profession. Because the bottom line is we can't get through this profession with ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can't do it solo. Right. Policing and first responders is a team sport. We have to understand we need resources and we need support from all over, from our families to the command staff to your peers to help us get through this profession safely. Mm-hmm.
Stacy and I want a copy of that QR code for ourselves.
Absolutely. We probably could do something on the side. Don't let the company listen to this podcast.
But you bring up an interesting point also, that in today's high-tech world, apps are becoming part of the wellness culture in police, fire, EMS. Can you talk a little bit? You don't have to get specific about the app necessarily, but just talk about how does it help the families? How does it help your employees?
Yeah, I think that any chief that cares about their people want them to have resources. See, the problem in our professions, fire service, EMS, has been confidential and anonymous, right? you know, many of us will throw out that we have EAP programs. Well, we all know that it stands for what? What does it stand for? Do you guys know?
Yep. Employee Assistance Program.
Right. But for our employees, they say expose and punish, EAP. Yeah. They don't trust our programs. Yeah. So giving our people an opportunity to have 24/7, 365 access at the palm of their hands when they need it most.
Right.
There's no other. I don't think there's any other mechanism or conduit for them to get help than to have something like that. Because the bottom line is, when do our people need these resources the most?
The middle of the night, basically.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
Right. We don't know when they need it most. So if we don't know, we have to have these resources available for them 24/7, 365. Right. So they don't have to call peer support. They don't have to call the chief. They don't have to call dispatch. They can get help anonymously and confidentially at the tip of their hands. You know, they just got into an argument with their spouse and they were drinking. And now they think they're going to lose their job maybe. And they're driving around. We want them to get help immediately. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think having a resource like that is so important. And I really don't think there's anything out there besides an app such as that that can do that and create that environment for us to go home at night and know that our people can get help and we have a clear conduit for them to reach out and ask for help.
Fantastic.
So I think that leads me to be thinking about, since the app can be used anywhere, especially on the outside where, you know, it could be any time of the day. I understand that there's something called the Zen Den, and that's in-house. I want to know where that's located. I want to know how many officers are using it. I mean, do you have any sense of people's reaction to it?
Yeah, we do. So we did kick off something called the Zen Den, and that room has an amazing chair. It does massage. It does compression. It has Bluetooth. It's just an amazing device. And we have a room set aside that we were intentional about that has aromatherapy in it. It has crystals in there. It has just different type of just creates an environment of that Zen. So people can go in and for two reasons. One, as a decompression room.
Right.
So after they have a traumatic call, if they feel they need some space to themselves, they have an opportunity to do that. The other one is for something that we don't talk about much is a restorative sleep room. Right. You know, in the fire services, you don't really have to worry too much about this. But in policing, sleep deprivation is a huge problem. You know, it leads to health or it leads to bad decisions. It leads to a host of different things. Yeah. We probably could have just a podcast on sleep deprivation for an hour. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that chiefs out there know their people are sleeping on the street. Why not create an environment where they could do it safely? Studies have shown that it's called a nappuccino. If you take a cup of coffee, you sleep for 20 minutes, you wake up, you're restored. And actually, it brings you into a better homeostasis. So you can go out and take care of your people and you could be healthy. And then you can help take care of your communities. So this room is set aside and we don't take any data as far as how many people are using it. But anecdotally, we hear about it all the time. And that room is almost constantly occupied. A lot of people are using it. They know it's something we believe in and it's a resource for them to go into and just kind of decompress. We invite them to also utilize either the Calm app, which is available, but we in our app itself has mindfulness exercises. It teaches them how to use mindfulness and meditation. So they really have an opportunity. It's an all-inclusive room. They can get restorative sleep. They can get mindfulness techniques and they can use it as a decompression room. And it's really been nothing but a huge success for us.
So how did you get the officers to not feel ashamed about like doing one of these, you know, as they approach the room, you know, like before they enter the room where they don't have shame about going in there?
You know, I think, Stacey, that goes for the whole, you know, the how to eat an elephant one bite at a time. I think you create that through creating that culture where you have chiefs going into a room like myself and sharing the actual story and sharing some of the traumatic events I have and also how I went out to seek help, right? And you share those stories and you create an environment of trust where people really believe in what you're doing. We have had no conversation when people are embarrassed about that room. In fact, people come out of that room and go, I was just out of the room. Who wants to go next? I mean, that is really what's working. Yeah. You know? You'll have some chiefs out there that want data, right? Where's the data and where's all these other, you know, measurable type of things? And the bottom line is if you're a chief like that, you're going to wait forever until you have that. But when you have people coming out of the room and people coming into your office say, I just want to thank you for thinking about us and creating that opportunity to create a room like that. it's you can see it on their face. You can see it in their day-to-day activities and interactions that it's such an impactful room. And really, what was it? Really just a thought about how we can enhance the abilities of our people to be healthy. And it didn't cost us much, right? Reached out to the company, and the company says, is this for a wellness room? We said, yes. We talked to them, and they actually gave us 50% off the chair. The chair normally is about $15,000. So you know what? There's so many partners out there who are willing to help law enforcement. If we are willing to raise our hand, even as a police chief, say, we need help from people outside our profession to get us through these type of difficult situations.
Well, Chief, we've covered a lot of great stuff, and I know we could keep going, but we'll probably have to come back for round two at another point. Love to just let people know where they can find you out there on the internet or social media. What are the best ways to find you out there?
Yeah, so they can reach me at my email, which is ngang@panole.ca.us, or it's even easier to reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I'd love to be able to partner with you and just kind of share experiences. Can I just share one other initiative that we started, Dave,
before we leave? Absolutely, yes.
You know, the national narrative out there, and there's a national argument, pretty contentious argument about whether or not these should be in the line of duty deaths and how do you handle them when people die. Should they be on a memorial wall in Washington? Should they be on our state memorial wall? Well, I'm not going to get into that whole political argument, but we started something here called Smash the Stigma Police Vehicle Design. And what we're doing is we're going to design a vehicle to raise awareness to PTSD and police suicide. And we're going to have a special livery for this vehicle. What we've done on LinkedIn at this point is invited anybody that has lost an employee to suicide and they want to honor them by giving them a voice and giving them some recognition. We're going to put their name on our vehicle. So that initiative is kicking off now, hopefully by the first quarter of next year. Currently, we have about 300 names. So, you know, whether or not it makes it to a wall in Washington or your state memorial wall, we're giving you an opportunity to reach out to us. Right. We're going to honor your loved one or your employee, your brother and sister in blue, by putting their name on our vehicle. So we encourage people out there that are listening, if you want to participate in this program, it costs nothing but sending your officer's name to us with a little bit of a paragraph about the facts surrounding what took place. And we want to honor and give a voice to those people that we have lost to suicide.
Yeah. Well, that is a quite inspiring initiative, and best of luck with that. I know it's probably going to be received very well. It's so unique, and it's a unique tribute to these people that have served and made a sacrifice. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for sharing so generously of your time and your expertise with us today.
Well, I can end with this, that I'm blessed to be able to partner with people like you, Dave, Bonnie, and Stacy. You know what? Because we will never know the lives that we save. And we never know that someone listening to this may change an outcome just because they heard something that we said today. And all I could say is I'm so blessed just to be a part of that. And like I said, it takes, you know, a village. And the bottom line is now we just expanded our village by sharing our message with people from all over the world about what you're doing and the resources bringing forward. So thank you for Responder Resiliency, for what you do and the efforts you put in. And I'm super blessed to be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Neil. Thank you.
Before we leave, I'd like to just remind everybody to subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's Responder Resilience. We're also on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out our website, respondertv.com. It's got past episodes and guest information. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.